If you look at the book Speakables and Unspeakables, it's the final chapter. The chapter is called Are There Quantum Jumps? Okay. So I'm giving you an interpretation of quantum theory. So I need to give you the ontology, the ontic state, and the dynamics. So these are the things that are real. It consists of two parts, a wave function. Okay, I'm just using the notation that John Bell used in his paper here. So the wave function is taken to be real. And then also B, in these interpretations, people give a way to get local beables. I'll explain what I mean by that. So the world seems to be made up of, tables and chairs, as I've said many times. And the question is, what are the tables and chairs made out of? What do they correspond to in the ontology? In the de Broglie-Bohm model, the local beables were the positions of the particles, and they provided tables and chairs. In the many worlds approach, you had to kind of reason that actually you could get the local beables out of the wave function, and you had to come up with this argument involving decoherence, which is okay perhaps, but a different approach is to actually posit some particular objects as corresponding to the local beables. So you could do that. You could follow the many worlds approach just here, because you've got a wave function. Now it's going to collapse, so you won't have the branching structure necessarily. Although even there, there is an issue, because the collapsing is not perfect, so there'll always be little tails. But usually people pursue a different approach. In fact, there's two approaches that people pursue. Either due to Bell, there's what's called the flash ontology. Or due to Garrady, there is the mass density ontology. And so there's two choices really there that you can make, and those are supposed to provide an answer to what tables and chairs and so on are made out of. That's the first thing we need. Then the second thing we need is the dynamics.
What do you mean, a way to get local variables? How to.
Well, there's something in the theory that we can point to that we say corresponds to tables and chairs. Okay, so. I'll show you what these are later. Okay, and then the second component is we need some dynamics. And this is given by the Schrodinger equation. Except when jumps occur. So next I need to tell you how these jumps occur. So the wave function evolves unitarily according to the Schrodinger equation, and every now and then, according to some equations I'm going to give you, a jump will occur. Okay. Okay, so first of all, so the jumps occur randomly, and the probability for a jump per unit time is n over tau. So n is the number of particles. I swear there's a drip coming from there. Tau is a new constant of nature, according to this model. It's a time scale.
Like, what do you mean for example? Like jump occur at time?
No, I mean every unit of time, the probability of, that one jump occurs is n over tau. Okay. Now, strictly speaking, this is a Poisson process. So strictly speaking, what we have is a Poisson distribution. So strictly speaking, the number of jump events So the probability of the number of event of jumps in some time t, the probability that number is equal to m, is given by e. This is just a Poisson distribution. That's but if you expand that for very small times, then the probability of a single jump is just n over tau. So yeah, tau is taken to be a new constant of nature. Now, in a deeper theory, if you were to try and derive some sort of collapse model from some deeper considerations, like the kind of considerations I was talking about yesterday, where you involve general relativity, then you might want to derive tau from some other constants. But so far as this model is concerned, tau is a new constant of nature. Okay. So that's how often the jumps happen. The jump itself is given by taking the wave function and acting on it with what's called a jump operator. And we also, afterwards, we renormalize the wave function. So I need to tell you what J is and what this renormalization factor is. And the other thing here is N. So N is chosen randomly. So what that means is with equal weight, we choose randomly any particular particle. Okay, it could be the first or the 23rd particle or whatever. We impose this normalization on the jump operator. Yeah.
The new psi on like what are its parameters on what does it depend? Still on the R's?
Yeah, so it's still a function of R. So I'll, let me write down what J is and then you'll see. So the usual choice is that J is like this. So J is given by this kind of function. So you can see if you hit the wave function with a function like this, then you're just going to get another wave function. So you're not introducing any new arguments. It's just a new wave function.
Which X?
Ah, yeah, and that's also important, yeah. X is another randomly chosen thing, yeah. Oh, but before I mention X, here there's also A here. And this is another fundamental constant of nature. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Eventually, J makes wave function being sharpened at particular position. X.
That's right. So typically, well, I'll explain this in a bit. But typically, A is going to be chosen to be quite big with respect to the typical quantum scales, so it doesn't sharpen very much small systems. But we'll see this in a moment. But you're exactly right. So yeah, the third point is the X. I should probably put. This is a, the third point is X. So so the clap center is chosen with this probability. Um, So this is, yeah, well, this is a probability distribution over over different over the x choices. And just one more point. So for these two fundamental constants of nature, in the original 1986 paper, GLW suggested that tau should be equal to 10 to the 15 seconds, which is about 10 to the 8 years. And A, they suggested, should be equal to 10 to the minus 5 centimeters. So 10 to the 8 years is a very long time. However, if you have a lot of particles, so for example, if you have of order Avogadro's number of particles, then this probability gets to be very high. And this number, 10 to the minus 5 centimeters, is quite big compared with, say, an atom. It's quite a large scale compared to the sort of typical size of quantum systems. But it's smaller than the resolution at which the eye can discern. I'll come to your question. Yes.
What's the function R? R n.
Which one? R n.
Yeah.
Oh. Oh yes. Did I not give that? I didn't. That should have gone at the end of point three. So Rn squared is equal to is equal to that. So it's what you need to normalize the wave function afterwards. But it's playing another role, as well as normalizing the wave function. I mean, of course, you take the square root of this. It's just a real number. But it's playing this role also of providing the probability. So the collapse center is more likely to be chosen where the amplitude of the wave function is bigger before the collapse happens. Okay. And there's no chance of the collapse center being chosen where the wave function has amplitude zero. Sorry. After the collapse happens. This is the probability is chosen with respect to the wave function after the collapse. Okay, so having this J here is interesting.
Here, the quantum job event is purely stochastic.
Yes. This is meant to be completely stochastic, yeah. So it's sort of fundamentally indeterministic, yeah. That's the idea.
And
this model, there is a sharp distinction between the collapse and the
collapse. That's right, yeah, yeah. So there are other models, collapse models, where they're called continuous collapse models, where the dynamics is all, the collapse is sort of happening all the time a little bit, and so that's a different kind of thing. So in this model, well, except this isn't measurement as such, because this happens regardless of whether you have something you would regard as a measurement apparatus. However, I'll show you that if you do have something that you would typically regard as a measurement apparatus, with a pointer, for example, then this gives you collapse for those things in the way that you want.
So even without the measurement process, like it evolves all of a sudden
collapse. Yeah, that's right, yeah. So even if you just have, for example, a single hydrogen atom sitting in its ground state, you know, isolated for billions of years, every so often it will undergo a collapse by itself, which will actually cause it to get, has some probability of causing it to get excited. And I guess it would emit a photon then. Yeah. So that's kind of the appeal of this, is that it's not saying that measurement apparatuses are special. Just saying this applies to any physical system, but it gives you what you want for measurement apparatuses.
Is there like more detailed rationale to pick
that number, like, minus 5? So they chose these numbers because by making tau big, but not too big, you would rarely see this effect if you had a single particle or even a small number of particles where you typically see quantum effects. On the other hand, it's not so big that if you have, say, Avogadro's number of particles, then this collapse happens very often. And this number was chosen so that it wouldn't typically affect small systems. So if you chose this number too small, if you chose this number to be on the scale of an atom, and if you had a mole of hydrogen atoms, you know, all just sitting there, by themselves, then you'd have a lot of hits. You had a lot of jumps in there, happening all the time, lots of them every second. And if this width was very small, it would cause the hydrogen atoms to get excited. So you'd see quite a strong effect. So there's actually quite a lot of constraints on how you can choose these numbers. And you know, since 1986, people have looked more closely at this model and put better constraints on whether these numbers fit with available data. I don't have the latest sort of version of the numbers on me. Okay, are there any, before I explain how the model works, what it does, any more questions on the model itself? Quite clear. Okay. So there's sort of two regimes. One where you have typical quantum experiments and you don't want to destroy the interference. And then the other regime is where you have measurement and you want to have collapse. So if you have a typical quantum experiment, superposition of a particle. So imagine it's in a superposition of being in two places. Imagine that this the size of the wave packets is much less than A. And that the distance between the two wave packets, for the sake of argument, this could be a particle traveling through a Mach Zehnder interferometer. I mean, it's just an example, really, to show you. I mean, these dimensions don't really matter. What's really important is that because you've only got a single particle, you only see a hit every 100 million years. you get a hit, and the position where the hit happens, where the jump happens, the clap center, is going to be in one of these two wave packets. Say it's over here. Then what will happen is you'll multiply this wave packet by the Gaussian, and it will just cause it to get slightly narrowed. Because this distance is much smaller than this, you'll just get a very slight narrowing. So it'll just come in a little bit from where it was before. And you'll kill the other one pretty much completely. Now, you won't kill it completely, because there'll be a slight tail. This Gaussian still has some non-zero weight over here. Very small, because this distance is big. But nevertheless, there is a small tail. Okay. But the main thing is that because the time scale, because of the time scale, this rarely happens. And so so quantum particles, a small number of quantum particles will behave pretty much as they do in standard quantum theory.
Is it also possible that the center of the J of X is now coincide with the center of the...
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it could be here. Yeah, so then you'll hit it. Again, if A is much bigger than the size of this, then it won't make a lot of difference. You just get a slight narrowing. Okay, but the more important example is when we have some measurement apparatus. So imagine we have a system. It passes through a box with a pointer, measures some property of the system, like its spin or something. Then afterwards, I'm just using sort of diagrammatic notation here. Afterwards, you'll go into a superposition of having the pointer go to the left or to the right. Something like that. So we can model this in just an approximate way. This is just to give you an idea of what happens in the model. So we can represent the wave function of particle one. We can represent this as sort of as a possible state for particle one. So we'll imagine that particle one is this particle, and then particles two through to n are in the pointer. And those particles are in some state. So this is maybe an overly simplified model, but it gives you the idea. Now, typically speaking, the particles that are in the pointer would themselves be, for each each position, they would be internally very entangled. But we can model it just by imagining that the particles in the pointer are in a product state initially. And then if we get result one, all the particles go into some state A1. And if we get, actually, this shouldn't be a, this should be a tensor product. And if they go into state two, if the pointer moves to the two position, then all the particles go to some different position. Okay, is that clear? Yes. No.
So each particle in the detector has the same wave function.
Yeah, we could give it a slightly different wave function for each particle, but the idea is that all the particles are either here or here. Okay. And we're simplifying the model by taking them to be just some big product state. For what I'm saying, it doesn't matter. And the same would go through if they were entangled. Okay.
So we would describe the pointer as an n minus 1 number of particles.
Yeah, all in some state, which is either here or in the other case here. Yeah. And we want it to be the case that the wave packets for the pointers, the pointer particles, are non-overlapping. So these two, the wave packets associated with A1 and A2 are not overlapping. Okay. So now n is going to be pretty large here, roughly 10 to the power 23. And so we're going to get a hit happening very, very quickly after almost no time at all. Suddenly, a small fraction of a second. And if this wave function, if one particle gets hit, well, what a hit does is, first of all, you choose a particle randomly from 1 up to n, most likely that's going to be a particle in the pointer. And then on that particular particle, you collapse so that the whole wave function is going to be hit by the jump operator. But you see, the jump operator will pretty much kill the term that the collapse center wasn't in. So if the collapse center is over here, in the two position of the pointer, then the jump operator is going to take the wave function, is going to basically take out this term completely. So after a jump, it's going to go. This. Actually, I should have used a product here, because these are just wave functions, not elements of a Hilbert space. I'm sorry if your notes are getting messy. Sorry about that. This is just a product of many wave functions. So. So is that clear? So the pointer is either in this position or this position. If you locate the position of any one of the particles, then necessarily you'd learn about the position of all the other particles as well. So the whole thing collapses to just one of the two positions. So you kill any macroscopic superposition if you have a state like this, where the particle positions are very entangled between the two terms. Sorry, say that again, sir.
The Bohr's rule, like alpha squared,
Oh, right, yeah, that's a good question. So you can show, you can show that the rate will, you'll get the right statistics for pointers, so that it will tend to favor the one with the bigger. You can show that the probability of getting a collapse here versus here tends to goes as beta squared. Now that isn't obvious, and I think you then have to look at the papers for more detail. It's a good question, which I didn't prepare anything on. I mean, you can sort of see it here. If your jump center is in one of the two, is in the, say, the two pointer position, then that's going to depend on beta squared here. This is going to be beta squared. That beta squared will come out. You won't really see the alpha at all, because it will kill that. Because this, you're calculating this R after you've hit it with a jump. So it won't really see the alpha at all. It'll just see the beta squared. And so the probability of getting the collapse center to be in the two position goes as is going to be depend on beta squared, and likewise for the other one, it's going to depend on alpha squared. So you can see it in this equation here. Again, there will be some small correction to that because of the tails. But the further away the pointer states are, and the bigger, the more particles, then the more that will be the case. I mean, of course, actually, you will have a lot of collapses. If n is equal to 10 to the power 23, then actually a pointer will be hit a lot of times.
How do you determine the number of particles participating in the system, like the probability of jump proportional to the number of particles?
It's the number of parts. So if your wave function is a product state, then you can just look at the, if your wave function is, you know, between your system and some other system is a product state, then you need only look at that system. The dynamics effectively factors out for the other system.
But we always have a freedom to expand our point of view for the system, right? So we can actually extend our point of view for whole universe.
Right, yeah. And fundamentally, you should, because fundamentally, this is meant to be for the whole universe. But from a pragmatic point of view, if you're trying to do the calculation, then as long as the system you're looking at factors out from some other system, then it won't matter very. It won't matter that the other system is there. Yeah. Any more questions on this? In this example, they're entangled because they have one term here and another term here. So the whole thing is very entangled.
So it's whether they factorize after the interaction, not before the interaction.
No, I mean before. Let's try and. You know, so imagine you've got a laboratory and you've got one experiment over on this table and another experiment on this table. And if this experiment is described by psi and this one by phi, and then you have a product state between them. Then I claim that so you could do the calculation for the whole laboratory with both tables, but I claim that actually the answers you would get would be the same as if you just did it for each of them separately using these equations. Because whenever a jump affects this one, whatever it does here, it doesn't. If you just have a single jump and it hits a particle which is in this on this table, then that jump doesn't affect this wave function. Okay. And likewise, this one. So if you're just interested in this table, then you need only look at the particles that are on that table, and then do all the calculations with this this wave function. I mean, I think there's a bit more to be said to really justify this claim. You'd have to do some more calculations, but I think you can see that that's the case. Yeah. Okay.
In this particular model, like, we introduce class like by hand, like just say, once in every time how class would happen, like, or is there any like such as the equation to actually do some calculation like running from cyborg?
Right. Okay. So that's so. Here's my next page. So there is a the version I've just given you is due to John Bell, and he tried to sort of pull out the main conceptual points. And so he expressed the model in terms of having a pure state being hit. But the original GRW model, they actually worked with a master equation. So they had the density matrix and they have a master equation. So the master equation. So you start off with your initial density matrix, which is now so it depends on the argument twice, so putting R and R prime in. So the initial one will be like this. Okay, so you have the wave function with all the arguments, and then you multiply the wave function with different arguments, sorry, with just primed versions of those arguments, and that gives you the initial density matrix. So we're not taking an inner product here because these have different arguments. So this is your initial wave function, and it's subject to a master equation, which looks like this. So this part, this is just the ordinary Schrödinger equation for a density matrix. Have you seen this in any course so far? You have, the quantum course, okay, good. But then there's a correction. No. This is a function. I'm yet to define this. So T sub n of rho. So you take rho and you hit both the unprimed and the primed arguments at the same clap center, and then you integrate over that, and that gives you this operator that acts on rho, and that's the thing that appears here. Okay. So the fact that you can write this down as a master equation does raise an interesting question. So in this model, we're taking the collapse to be fundamental. The system really is collapsing. But you can get master equations that look just like this by having a system interact with an environment and tracing over the environment. So from an experimental point of view, if you wanted to be sure that you were seeing the collapse process, you would have to be sure you'd eliminated all the possible decoherence effects that might look the same. Okay. Yeah, I think you need to look at the paper if you want to see where that's coming from. So this is meant to correspond to this process, understood, but understood as a master equation. So you just integrate out, or you sum over all the possible jump processes, and you get this. But if you look at the GLW paper, then you'll see more details. Okay. Which one?
I would say the second.
Which J? Oh.
Unless J is real.
So the example of J we took, he was real. But of course, this is just an example.
In the above four, you sort of imply that J could be complex.
Yeah, so I think you're right. I think if J is anything other than that, if J is complex, then you're right. You would need a star there, for sure. So I'll put a star, because it doesn't hurt a star. Yeah. Good point. Yeah, I took this equation from the GLW model, the paper, and they may have just assumed that J was always equal to that, whereas John Bell may have raised the possibility it could be different. Yeah. Yeah, no, it would have to be. Yeah, it has to be. Okay. So then I mentioned at the beginning that there are two ontologies. There's two ways of getting local Beobles, the flash ontology and the mass density ontology. Okay, where can I? So the question is, what are tables and chairs made out of? So John Bell suggested that they're made out of the flashes. So these are the collapse centers. So remember, we have to choose these x's randomly. If you have a quantum system, a small quantum system, then you're very unlikely to have any collapses. But if you have a big system, like a pointer, or a piece of chalk, then all the time inside that, there'll be these little flashes. And the idea is that tables and chairs are made out of these flashes. Because they happen all the time, then they are sufficient to provide an ontology that will tell you that you have things like tables and chairs. Okay. So in this, from this point of view, you've got the wave function, which is a real thing, but you've also got these flashes, and they're also real, and they correspond to the local Biables. This wouldn't be an option if you had a continuous collapse model, if the collapses were happening continuously all the time. One other thing, of course, is that these flashes live in three-dimensional space. So they provide a three-dimensional picture of the world. And then the other point of view is the mass density ontology. This is due to Karadi. Grassi. And Benati. So in a sense, they were really responding to what John Bell had done. And they define a mass density operator. So the idea is this operator, this is the mass of the kaif particle. Kaif. And this here is the number operator for the number of particles. So K labels types of particles. For the kth type of particles, this is the number operator for how many particles there are of that type in a small volume of size A. And M is the mass of the kth type of particle. So you can use that to get a mass density. By acting with this on the wave function. And then they take this mass density to be the thing that's real, that provides a picture of tables and chairs.
Is that A, size A, the same fundamental size?
I think it's just the same as the fundamental size in the paper. But there's no reason why it could be any size, I suppose. It could be B. I think the same idea would work.
Is that M, like both mass operator?
Sorry, which one? Which one, sorry?
The second MK.
MK is the mass of each particle of type K. So So that's the picture. There's sort of an issue here that when you, if you look at that pointer example I gave, this mass density will have some value in the tails, you know, because you're just using a Gaussian to cut off the other term. Although the pointer will mostly be here, there'll be a very, very, very small mass in the other position. And you might say, well, this makes this sort of similar, you know, to the sort of many worlds in denial kind of picture, that just because these worlds have very low mass associated with them, they're still there and they have all the structure. And so there's kind of a problem there if you take this version of the ontology. This flash ontology doesn't seem to have that problem because the flashes are very well localized. Okay, I'll finish tomorrow on the collapse. Not tomorrow, Monday. Yep.
So this mass density is all there is to the ontic state in this model, or?
No, there's also the wave function. So the wave function is a real thing, but it's not a local Biebel. So the idea is you've got two kinds of ontological thinking. You've got the wave function, which just provides, you know, some non-local thing that exists in configuration space. And then you've also got something which provides local Biebels. And that's either the flash ontology or the mass density function, depending on which one you take.
But the mass density function doesn't distinguish between different types of particles.
Right, yeah. I think it's a very ad hoc approach. It's just they're just trying to make some suggestion. Yeah, it tells you if you have a table or chair, but it doesn't tell you what color the table or chair is. And that's a,